VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
September 11, 2001. The day will forever live in infamy as an Islamic terrorist attack was launched against the United States, making it the deadliest in American history. Nearly 3,000 lives were taken that day, and millions across the nation have been impacted. Today we're going to be taking a look back at history at the date of 9/11. The Muslim Day of Infamy precedes September 11, 2001. I think you'll find today's discussion quite interesting. Joining us today, we welcome William Federer. Bill is a nationally known speaker, author, and president of Amerisearch Incorporated, a publishing company dedicated to researching America's noble heritage. He has authored many books, including America's God and Country, Encyclopedia of Quotations, The Original 13, History of Religion, America's First 13 States, Who is the King in America, and What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam in the United States. He's a speaker in the American Minute Daily Broadcast. Bill, so good to have you back with us here on Crosstalk.
Jim, great to be with you.
Well, before we talk about some of the dates in history, Bill, no doubt 9/11 is forever going to hold meaning, especially as we saw news footage unfold that day of September 11th. Some of our listeners, I know, were in D.C. or one of the other locations at that time. But, Bill, you no doubt, too, remember where you were when you heard news of this attack.
Yes, I did. I was at a funeral for an attorney, Charlie Shaw, and he was a friend of our family and especially of help when I ran for Congress years ago. But it is critical for us to understand the basic concept of Islamic military expansion, and that is, when your enemy is strong, retreat. When your enemy is weak, attack. And this is basically the law of nature. If you run from a dog, it'll chase you. but if you show strength, it'll stop. And so there's 1,400-year history of Islamic military expansion. And whenever they sensed that the enemy was weak, they would attack. Whenever they lost major battles, they would retreat and become more peaceful for a generation or two, sort of go into remission. If somebody ever had measles as a kid, then it comes back as chicken pox later when your resistance is low. That's sort of an example of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this date of 9/11, it was just not some random day pulled out of the hat. Rather, you have researched, you have found that 9/11 has great significance to Muslims. And we're going to work through some of these dates. And the first date that you present is that of September 11th, 1565.
Right, so the Sultan is Suleiman the Magnificent, and he wanted to rule the world. He controlled the Ottoman Empire, which by this time was all in North Africa, which people forget used to be Christian. Morocco, Algiers, Tunisia, Libya, it was all Greco-Roman, Judeo-Christian, with 250 Catholic dioceses in the 7th century. And St. Augustine was from Hippo in North Africa. Today that's Tunisia. And then the Muslims conquered Egypt, which used to be Christian for 6 centuries, evangelized by Mark that wrote the gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, until Amir ibn Alas conquers it. Jerusalem used to be Christian, right? We have Constantine converts, and the Roman Empire becomes Christian, and his mother, St. Helena, goes to Jerusalem and builds all these big cathedrals where she thinks Christ's passions took place and so forth. And then Syria was completely Christian, evangelized by the Apostle Paul. The name Christian was first used in Syria until Caliph Umar conquers it. And then they invade into Armenia. And then Turkey used to be the Byzantine Christian Empire. All 7 churches mentioned in the book of Revelation were all wiped out by the Muslim Turks. These letters in the New Testament to Ephesus and Colossae and Galatia and Philippi and Corinth, all those cities were wiped out by the Muslim Turks. You can take a tour trip to Turkey and go to Izmir. It's the old Ephesus, and you can see all the ruins. And then the Muslims conquered Constantinople in the year 1453, which cuts off the land routes to India and China. That's when Columbus had sailed looking for a sea route. And then the Muslims invade into Eastern Europe. the Balkans, Wallachia, Moldova, Bulgaria, Romania, and then they finally surround Vienna, Austria. The year is 1529, and the Sultan is Suleiman the Magnificent. And, of course, Martin Luther had just started the Reformation a few years earlier. Charles V of Spain is the Catholic Holy Roman Emperor. He has, from his perspective, a double dilemma, Reformation on one hand and Muslim invasion on the other hand. And so he ends up doing a deal with the Protestants called the Peace of Augsburg, which allows every king to believe what he wants in his kingdom as long as they work together against Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent. So here's the year 1565, and the Muslims are now dominating the Mediterranean Sea. Sicily, Sardinia, Majorca, the coast of Spain, and they're headed toward Rome. But there's this little island south of Sicily. It's a fortified island called Malta. We know that in the Bible because the Apostle Paul was shipwrecked there. And so there's 40,000 Muslim soldiers on 200 ships, and they have 6,500 elite Janissary troops. They surround this island. And Dragut Reis is the pirate admiral for the Muslims. And he said, unless you have smoked out this nest of vipers, you can do no good anywhere. So he says, we have to get this fortified city of Malta. Queen Elizabeth said, if the Turks should prevail against the island of Malta, it is uncertain what further peril might follow the rest of Christendom. People forget the Muslim pirates actually captured one of the pilgrim ships. In 1625, a few years afterwards, the pilgrims sent a ship back to England filled full of beaver skins for trade. Muslim pirates captured it, took them to Morocco, sold them into slavery. So the head of the Knights of Malta was 70-year-old Jean Lavalette, and he pleads for reinforcements across Europe. None come. They think it's hopeless. You can't defeat the Muslims. So Lavalette gets his young Knights of Malta, and he says, a formidable army composed of audacious barbarians is descending on this island. These persons, my brothers, are enemies of Jesus Christ. Today, it is a question of the defense of our faith as to whether the Gospels are to be superseded by the Quran. God, on this occasion, demands of us our lives, already vowed to his service. Happy will be those who first consummate this sacrifice. So he's like, okay, you vowed to give your life for Christ when you joined this Knights of Malta. Guess what? You're going to have to give your life here. So the Turks surround the island, and they pound away with their cannons. For weeks, just relentlessly pounding away, some of the young knights escape out of one of these castles and get to the main castle, and Jean Lavalette said, what are you doing here? You're supposed to go back here and fight till you die. And so they go back, and sure enough, they climb out of the rubble, fight the Muslims, and then the Muslims pound them with cannons some more, and then they climb out of the rubble, fight them some more. And this goes on for month after month. Finally, the Muslims blow a hole through the last wall in the last castle, and everybody runs to the back, and Jean Lavalette, the 70-year-old guy, stands in the gap, and the dust settles, and the Muslims see this one old guy standing there, and they hesitate. The rest of the knights say, well, we're going to die anyway. We may as well die with him. And so they don't just come to his side. They rush out. And the Muslims didn't expect to blow a hole in the wall and have people flood out of the hole. And so out flood all these knights, and they're just yelling and fighting, and they rout the Muslims and cause them to retreat, and they're tripping over themselves, and they're falling down the hill. And finally, a couple boatloads of reinforcements come, and their Dragut admiral dies, and the Muslims sail away on September 11th, 1565. Mm-hmm. It's the first major defeat of the Muslim navy. When Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent finds out about it, he's furious. He vows to destroy all of Europe, and he dies a year later. His son, Salim the Drunkard, takes over, who spends a lot of time with his harem. And so this battle there at Malta, September 11, 1565, was the beginning of the Muslims losing control of the Mediterranean Sea. It was a major defeat for them.
My, very interesting. That's September 11, 1565. We're going to advance 118 years to September 11th, 1683.
Right. So this is the same year that William Penn is founding Pennsylvania. And you have Sultan Mehmed IV, and he has 138,000 Muslim Turks, and they're surrounding Vienna, Austria. Their general is Mustafa Pasha. And so for 2 months, they're surrounding and starving the Austrian Habsburg defenders. And so you have 200,000 outside, only 11,000 defenders. Sultan Mehmed IV sends a message to the king of Austria, Leopold. He said, "Await us in your residence so we can decapitate you." Anyway, to his rescue comes the Polish king, Jan Sobieski. He gathers 81,000 of these Polish troops and Austrians and Germans, and he has a surprise attack on the Muslims on September 11th, 1683. And he has one of the largest cavalry charges in history. 38,000 of these cavalry, the soldiers had made wings for their back. And when they charged down this hill, like the whole hillside slid down, and these wings made this enormous flapping, whistling noise together with the galloping of the horses, and it just echoed across the valley, and the Muslim soldiers freaked out, dropped their weapons, and fled. And Jan Sobieski fights them off, and then he goes into the abandoned Muslim camps. Now, this victory was so important that the Pope hailed Jan Sobieski as the savior of Western civilization. And one of the quotes from Teddy Roosevelt, he is talking in his book, Fear God and Take Your Own Part, in 1916. Teddy Roosevelt said, "From the hammer of Charles Martel to the sword of Jan Sobieski, Christianity owed its safety in Europe to the fact it could and would fight as well as the Muslim aggressor." So Jan Sobieski is the hero. And then he goes through the abandoned Muslim tents. And lo and behold, he finds bags of beans, coffee beans, and realizes this was this new Muslim drink called coffee. And shortly thereafter, one of the Polish generals, Klosowski, opens the first Vienna coffee house. Now, they weren't sure if they should drink coffee because it was, after all, the Muslims' drink. Coffee came from Ethiopia, which was one of the few countries in Africa to stay Christian. It was Abyssinia, or the Queen of Sheba came from there. And so here, the beans came from this Christian African country, Ethiopia. The Muslims called the Christians infidels. The Muslim word for infidel is kafir, or kafir, which is where we get the word coffee. And so here you have this drink called infidel, called coffee. And now they weren't sure if they should drink it. So they took a cup of it to Pope Clement VIII. And he tasted it and said, "This is too good to leave for the Muslims. Let's baptize it." And then coffee spread across Europe.
Oh, my.
So have you had your cup of infidel today? But it's okay to drink. Pope Clement said so.
September 11th, 1683 was the date for that. Folks, we'll be back in just 1 minute. September 11th, a look through history. Bill Fitter is our guest. This is Crosstalk on VCY.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, popular creation speaker with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, did Noah's Ark have to contain two of every species we find on planet Earth today?
Not at all, Chris. In fact, this is a straw man argument used by those who really don't believe in Noah's Ark at all. The Bible says that God created each basic type of animal after its kind, and that Noah was to bring two of each kind of animal on board the ark. Kind would be represented by the basic categories of animals today, such as the dog kind. Within the dog kind, there are several species. That's the wolves and the foxes and the coyotes and the dingoes. They are called species, but they're all interfertile. They're all part of the dog kind. There was plenty of room on board the ark for two of each of these various kinds of land-dwelling, air-breathing animals. The Bible story holds water, as it were. We read about it when we go back to Genesis.
For more on creation, visit our website at www.icr.org.
You're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America. Bill Federer is with us today, nationally known speaker, author. He's an historian, the president of Amerisearch Incorporated, and we're talking today about September 11th, a look through history, and taking a look at some dates in the past, September 11th, 1565. And Bill, we're talking right now about September 11th, 1683. We certainly have learned about certainly the Islamic invasion, then leaving the tents, the founding of coffee and so forth. Before we move on to the next date, something more you wanted to share on this date.
Right. So the Muslims would mine, they would dig tunnels under the walls of the castles that they were assaulting. And then they would place gunpowder in these tunnels right under the wall and then seal it off, ignite, light the fuse, and it would blow up and the wall would go up and then down and crash. And then the Muslims would crawl over the rubble and climb into the city. And so they're surrounding Vienna, Austria. And a baker is up early baking bread in Vienna, and he hears some noise under the ground, some clanking noise, some mining, and he tells the soldiers, and sure enough, the Muslims are tunneling under the walls of Vienna. And so they put out buckets of water, and they can see the ripples and sort of see where the ripples are the most intense, and they can sort of triangulate and figure out where they're digging. And so they dig a tunnel and intercept it. And they get in there just at the time the Muslims had sealed it off and they were about to light it. And so they quickly defuse it and it saves the city. Afterwards, they were going to award the baker for warning them. And he said, I don't need a reward. Just give me the sole permission to cook a pastry in the shape of the Muslim crescent. And it was called the croissant, the crescent roll. So the next time you have coffee and croissants, you can celebrate the victory of the Battle of Vienna, September 11th, 1683. Mm-hmm. Now, this was the beginning of the end of the Ottoman Empire. From this battle on, they began to lose other battles and other battles. So it was sort of like the Gettysburg for the Confederacy. It was the furthest that the Ottomans were able to go into Europe, and from that time, their empire began to shrink. And an interesting quote from Hilaire Belloc. He was called one of the great Edwardian writers in England about the same time as Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and so forth. So you have this writer named Hilaire Belloc, and he writes this in 1938. He said, less than 100 years before the American War of Independence, a Mohammedan army was threatening to overrun and destroy Christian civilization. Vienna was almost taken and only saved by the Christian army under the command of the King of Poland on a date that ought to be among the most famous in history, September 11th, 1683.
Wow, wow.
So I'm not just saying, oh, this was an important date. Here's this writer in 1938 saying, of all the dates in world history, September 11th, 1683 is the big one because it was the ending of the Ottoman Muslim Empire invading into Europe.
Let's advance into September 11th, 1697.
So we're all familiar with the Georgia, right? It's a state. It was a colony founded by a guy named James Oglethorpe. James Oglethorpe, before he founded Georgia, was a soldier, and he fought in Europe under Eugene of Savoy, and he was one of the commanders that helped stop the Muslims. So the big battle that Eugene of Savoy fought was in Belgrade. We're familiar with Belgrade, Serbia, because the Serbians had fought to keep the Muslims out of Europe. Bill Clinton bombed the Serbians, Belgrade, Serbia, and he had Americans help the Muslim forces, but that's a different story. So here's James Oglethorpe, and then he fought for Eugene of Savoy. Eugene of Savoy is there, September 11th, 1697. 100,000 Muslims are invading Belgrade, Serbia, and Eugene of Savoy is able to fight back, and it's one of the great victories. It happened on September 11th, 1697, the Battle of Zenta, Z-E-N-T-A. 30,000 Turkish Ottoman Muslims are killed, and only 500 of Eugene of Savoy's men are killed. And so this was just a tremendous victory for Christian Europe. And again, this was the continuing the momentum of the Muslim Ottoman Empire shrinking. Now, why is it important for us to remember these dates? Christianity primarily is an individual religion. It's you and Jesus. Jesus says, you have to love me more than you love your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, more than anybody else. You got to be willing to give up the praise from every single person, and it's just you and Jesus. Not so with Islam. Islam is primarily a group religion, not an individual religion. And so they call it an ummah, a community. It's a group. It's the best way we can explain it. It's a team. It's a brotherhood, the Muslim brotherhood. It's a team. And so it has this group mentality that's subject to the dynamics of groups, and that's peer pressure. And so people want to fit in with the group. And from little kids in preschool wanting to wear the same tennis shoes as everybody else, everybody wants to fit in with the group. And so Islam, you see the pictures of them publicly praying, all bowing. Well, guess what? It would, if you stood and refused to bow, the peer pressure is immense. So everybody is forced to bow. And why is this important? Well, when you understand the team aspect, if the gang or the team loses over and over and over again, let's say your alma mater, you went to high school, and they lose every game, you're embarrassed. Their honor is gone. It's shameful. But how does your team regain its honor? Maybe win. And so since September 11th has been these three major defeats that have turned the Muslim Empire back, and it's been a shame. How do you regain your honor? Well, you win on September 11th. And so that is the reasoning that most are convinced of, that why they picked that date to do the 2001 Islamic terrorist attacks on the Twin Towers and on the Pentagon, and then the one that crashed in Pennsylvania. And
Bill Fitter here with us today on Crosstalk, September 11th, a look through history, and I hope this is helping to gain understanding as to the significance of September 11th. We have defeat, we have defeat, and Bill, take us to September 11th, 2001.
And so President Bush says freedom itself was attacked this morning with a faceless coward. Freedom will be defended that evening. President Bush said thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil, despicable acts of terror. Pictures of planes flying into buildings, burning huge structures, collapsing, have filled us with disbelief, terror, sadness. And he goes on to say America was targeted because we're the brightest beacon for freedom and opportunity in the world. And I ask for your prayers for all those who grieve. And then he ends with a quote from Psalm 23, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil. Now, after Bush, we did show strength, and we went over to the Middle East, and we established American supremacy. But what happened? We did not have an understanding of the Islamic mindset. I was speaking at a church one time, and afterwards visiting with people, and one was a soldier, and he said that he had been on several tours over there, you know, in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he showed me he had a scar on his arm, and he said, I was giving some of my cookies that were in my MRE, meals ready to eat, to the little Muslim kids around me, and he says, one of them, instead of taking the cookie, he reached past it with a knife and stabbed me in the arm. And the soldier looks up at me and says, why did he do that? And I said, you have to understand, you're showing weakness. They take your niceness as weakness, and they take that as an indicator to attack. I was talking to another congressman, I think it was Stephen Russell, and he's the one who pulled Saddam Hussein up out of the hole. And he said, when we first went over there and we showed strength, it was all peace. They were all afraid of us, and they were all doing what we told them. And then we went to giving out soccer balls and giving out candy and giving out money and everything, and we became real approachable. And he says, that's when the terrorist attacks began. So we have to understand their mindset that they've dealt with for 1,400 years is, when your enemy is strong, retreat. When your enemy is weak, attack. It's basically the way nature is. that a shark can sense a weak animal in the water, and it's drawn to want to go over and attack it.
Mm-hmm.
And so weakness invites aggression. And so when Bush was out, and President Obama gives his famous speech, mission accomplished, and he pulls all the Americans out, we sent a signal that we were retreating. And this is a sign of weakness. And it goes all the way back to Muhammad himself. So here's Muhammad. He flees from Mecca to Medina. He's like an immigrant. The Medina is ruled by a bunch of Jews, three Jewish tribes, and they're nice and let him in. And he goes into the minority neighborhoods, and he begins to organize a following. We're familiar with the term of organizing in the community. When Muhammad's following gets big enough, he goes to the Jews and pressures them to accommodate him and his followers politically. And they make a treaty. Now Muhammad's a political leader. When Muhammad's followers get chased out of Mecca, they're like Muslim refugees. They come into this Jewish city of Medina as Muslim immigrants. Muhammad organizes them, and he then has them attack the caravans headed to Mecca in retaliation for the Meccans chasing them out of town. And anyway, so the Meccans send 1,000 soldiers to escort their caravan, and Muhammad with 300 men defeats 1,000 of these soldiers. And then he goes back into the Jewish city of Medina, and he drives out the Jews. And so it's this idea that he first came in weak, and his opponents were strong, but then he gained in strength, and his opponents became weak. And when they were weak, that's when he attacked them and drove them off. And so we see this concept go repeat itself throughout history. And the Muslims conquered the Byzantine Empire, the Persian Sassanid Empire. And then when the great schism between the Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholics happened, they attacked the Eastern Orthodox. And then the Romans sent the Roman Catholics sent the Crusades. When they end, the Muslims advance and surround Vienna, Austria. And so it's a concept we need to understand. Why? Because we think if we can just give in to them a little bit more, they'll reciprocate and become nice.
It doesn't happen that
way. They view that niceness as weakness, and so that's why the nicer these Western countries are, the more violent they become.
So let's advance to September 11, 2012.
It's interesting. Here's the UN. It was formed, you know, with Truman and Eleanor Roosevelt was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And she spends all this time writing a Declaration of Human Rights. It's really great. It says that there's going to be equality and so forth, and everyone has the right to join a religion and leave a religion. Women are equal to men. Well, what happens is Muslim countries join the United Nations. And they form a UN inside the UN. It's called the OIC, Organization of Islamic Cooperation. And they have their Cairo Declaration of Human Rights.
Bill, let's leave it right there. We're going to pick up with this after the break. Bill Federer with us today. September 11th, a look at history. And we're up to September 11th, 2012. Some more information to follow. This is Crosstalk on VCY America.
We are concerned for our nation. The pathway on which we're headed is one destined for destruction. Collectively, our nation celebrates what God calls an abomination. Children are killed daily by abortion. Secularism is on the increase. The Bible and Christianity under attack. That which is evil is declared good, and that which is good is declared evil. In the book, The Coming Destruction of America, Pastor Neil Jackson undertakes a biblical examination of the judgments of God upon a land. You'll see what happens to a nation that rejects God's ways, rejects God's words, and rejects God's warning. It's a book that calls America to repentance to avoid the judgment of God upon our beloved land. This hardcover book, The Coming Destruction of America, is available for a donation of $17 or more to VCY. Obtain your copy by calling 1-800-729-9829. 1-800-729-9829.
William Federer is our guest here today on Crosstalk, and he's an historian. He is certainly nationally known as a speaker, president of Amerisearch, author of many, many books, including the book What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam and the United States, and recounting for us today, September 11th, a look through history, and certainly much that we can be learning as to the defeats that have happened in Islam, and why it was important for September 11th for them to have victory to take place. We'll be getting more into that, but we're right up now to September 11th of 2012, where Bill was just telling us about this UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and talking about this being adopted by the UN General Assembly. But now we have Islamic nations who are joining into the United Nations. And Bill, you said they formed the OIC document?
Right. So this is a UN inside the UN. And so there are 57 Muslim countries. It's the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC. And they don't like this UN Declaration of Human Rights. And so they decide to do their Cairo Declaration of Human Rights, which is what? The death penalty for leaving Islam, punishing women who are the victims of rape, allowing men to be polygamous, permitting wife beating, and censoring speech insulting Islam.
Hmm.
This is important to understand. For these 1,400 years of Islamic expansion, whenever they would conquer a country, the people they conquer were forbidden to insult Islam. It's one of the telltale signs that you've been conquered. If you insult Islam, they kill you. They made it so that you could not have a meeting of people in your home without a Muslim being present to make sure you weren't plotting to overthrow the country. The dhimmi, which is the second-class citizens, had to ransom their lives once a year with this exorbitant tax called a jizya. Very similar to the Chicago mob would come into your store and say, give me the money in your cash register for protection money. And if you don't give them the money, the next day your store is trashed. And so these Christians in these countries, like in Egypt, in Pakistan, in, Indonesia, in obviously there are no Christians in Saudi Arabia, but all these minority Christians, they are living as second-class citizens on thin ice. I hate to use the example, but it's very similar to the way the Democrats treated blacks in the Deep South after the Civil War. So Lincoln, Republican, freed the slaves. Republicans pushed through the 13th Amendment, ending slavery. Republicans pushed through the 14th Amendment to give rights to the freed slaves. Republicans pushed through the 15th Amendment, making sure the freed slaves could vote. Democrats in the Deep South were passing Jim Crow laws and black codes, making slaves and making the blacks into second-class citizens. They had to be on the back of the bus and so forth. And so if a black person spoke out against a Democrat in the South, they could get lynched. Today, they try to make it look like a white-black issue. No, it's not white and black. It's Democrat-Republican. There were about 4,000 documented lynchings. 1,000 of those were white Republicans in the South organizing and registering the blacks to vote. The white Republicans got lynched along with the blacks. It was the Democrats versus Republicans. It wasn't white versus black. And so the sad chapter in American history is how these Democrats treated the blacks in the Deep South. That is how Christians are treated in Muslim countries. That if they want to be equal, they could get lynched, and there's no justice. The Muslim can come in your house and take your wife, take your daughter. They can. So in Cairo, Egypt, for centuries, the Christians have been called garbage people because they could never hold a job higher than a Muslim. And so they would spend their day rummaging through garbage to try to eke out a living. And so so why is this important? And so when we in the West begin to be really careful not to insult Islam, we're sending a mixed signal. We're posturing ourselves as having been defeated. And so the Muslims come from their Muslim countries, right, like in Syria and so forth. The Christians have to show deference to the Muslim, you know, and get off the street if they're walking by and put them up in their house for 3 days and feed them if they want. And so they come over here to America, and then what happens? The population is showing deference to the Muslims. They say, hey, you're acting like you're Dhimmi. You're acting like you've been submitted. And so in Islam, they have the concept, when your enemy is weak, attack. It emboldens them. One time I was visiting with a Muslim terrorist who became a Christian, and his name is Kamal Saleem. He's a great speaker. And Kamal said that when they sense that you are afraid of them, they take that as an indicator from Allah that they are supposed to attack you. And again, it's sort of like, you know, like a shark can sense,
right.
Fear. If they sense fear, they take that. And so it's interesting that every single book in the Bible, somewhere in there, it says, fear not. That the God of the Bible says, don't fear, have faith. But here, so when we are really careful not to offend them, that's an indicator for them to get more violent. And you say, well, how are you supposed to act as a Christian? There's two different things. There's the commands of God to you individually. Actually, God gives commands to five different groups: individuals, families, husbands, wives, children, to employers and employees, pay an honest wage, and so forth, to the church, and to the government. And what we do is we mix up the commands. It's not the government's job to be generous and be charitable. It's the government's job to protect the innocent, punish the guilty. It's just to defend the country. That's the government's job. What we mix up is your personal witness. You love people, right? But as the country goes, the government is supposed to protect the people inside the country. And it's not supposed to let in those who have an agenda to destroy. So anyway, so we're back to the OIC, the United Nations, we have Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. In December 12, 2011, Hillary Clinton meets in a three-day closed-door session with the OIC. And it's called the Istanbul Process. And they are talking about one thing: criminalizing speech insulting Islam. And they want to enforce this all across the country, all across the world. And so we saw that in Denmark, there was a cartoon that insulted Islam. And the EU, knee-jerk, immediately gave up free speech rights and said, everybody in Europe cannot insult Islam. So basically, they made Europe into Dhimmi status. And so the idea is you create this crisis and you can push through an agenda. There's a whole theory behind that, that people won't change the status quo. There has to be some crisis that motivates them to give up their rights. And so there's a whole political science on how to create and manufacture crises. So if you ever see these bills, they say, well, they whip the country up. We have to hurry up and pass this health care bill. It's an emergency. What's the emergency? President Obama set a deadline. Okay, that's the emergency. And so we have Nancy Pelosi saying, we have to hurry up and pass this thing so we can find out what's in it. It's like it was this manufactured crisis. And so you need a crisis to push an agenda where people give up their freedoms. And so here's Hillary. She's the Secretary of State. And she denies repeated requests from the ambassador, Chris Stevens, in Libya for protection. And then there's this crisis, and he's killed. And it's now come out that Obama and Hillary were watching from cameras and circling drones of the whole thing happening. And the Americans were ready to take off and fly. They could have been there in an hour, and that they were ordered to stand down. And from all indications, it looked like they wanted to have a crisis of the killing of these people. And immediately, the very next day, Hillary Clinton blames some obscure video, and then she sends a memo to YouTube and Google, and she says, censor speech insulting Islam, which is exactly what she promised the people a year earlier at the OIC.
Wow.
And Obama picks up on the narrative. Susan Rice picks up on the narrative. Obama speaks to the UN. The future does not belong to those who slander the prophet of Islam. They were almost getting away with it until they discovered the journal of Ambassador Chris Stevens, and he was saying, Hillary, give me help, give me help, give me help. And then all of a sudden, it was exposed that it had nothing to do with that video, that this was a planned attack, and it was supported by the Muslim Brotherhood leader of Egypt, Morsi, with the help of President Obama, and then the narrative got off, and now they're finding out that it was just a that they were doing a gun running through Libya, that Benghazi was the port that they were taking guns that we used to overthrow the Gaddafi in Libya, and they were moving guns through Benghazi to Syria because they wanted to overthrow Assad in Syria. But it's important for us to understand. So here this September 11th, 2012, and we have these Americans killed in Benghazi, and we're wondering what was behind it all, and now we're beginning to see that there was an agenda being played out. And the Judicial Watch, which is a group that monitors and corruption in government, they filed Freedom of Information Act requests regarding Benghazi. And sure enough, they uncover the documents that it was a fast and furious gun-running operation. So here we have Eric Holder, Attorney General, is caught giving guns to Mexican drug terrorists. And here we have Hillary Clinton giving American guns to Muslim terrorists over there in Libya and then in Syria. And so this is part of this larger plan to have an Islamic caliphate. They want to retake the Ottoman Empire, all those countries, and put it under the one Muslim leader called a caliph. So I bring up all these different things to say that if we show weakness, which we have been nationally, it's an encouragement to the fundamentalist Muslim to become more violent. Now, there are lots of moderate Muslims, and they just want to live their lives. But again, when you understand it's a group religion, they go with whatever the peer pressure is. And if the local imam says we have to move in a more fundamentalist direction, they have to follow the imam.
And by fundamentalists, we're talking, they're referring even to the taking the Quran exactly for what it says and to kill the infidels, to kill the Christians and Jews. Bill, here just quickly before our break. And folks, if you'd like to get online, our phone number to Crosstalk, 800-733-9829, 800-733-9829 today for Crosstalk. When we look at the groups, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, Hamas, Hezbollah, Abu Sayyaf, the Islamic Jihad, Muslim Brotherhood, it's important to know that their goal is to establish this caliphate, an Islamic state under Islamic law, otherwise known as Sharia, and they promise to use all means necessary.
Yeah, it's a one-world government. And even Martin Luther brought out that Islam is anti-Christ. Martin Luther says the Turk is the flesh of Antichrist. And so all other major world religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, so forth, started before Christianity. So those religions could not specifically mention Christianity. Islam came 600 years after Jesus, and it specifically mentions Christianity. And it has an unforgivable sin called shirk, S-H-I-R-K, shirk. And if you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, the Christ, you have committed the unforgivable sin called shirk that condemns you to hell.
Well,
you cannot be any more anti-Christ than by saying if you believe in Christ, you go to hell. So if there ever was a religion of anti-Christ, it sort of fits the definition.
Bill Fitter, our guest, we'll get to your phone calls after the break here for the final segment. This is Crosstalk on VCY America.
For the Worldview Week in Minute, I'm Brandon House. Our website's worldviewradio.com. Was Joseph McCarthy right? Indeed, he was right more than he probably even knew. And sadly yet, his name has become a pejorative today. If you speak truth against, well, communism, socialism, Marxism, even Islam, you're accused of McCarthyism. But McCarthy was right. And how do we know that? Because in 1995, the Venona Project files were open. The Venona Project ran from February 1st, 1943 to October 1st, 1980. Our government was intercepting encrypted messages from the Soviet Union to their spies here in America that were at the highest levels of our government. They had infiltrated into the Treasury Department, the State Department, and even one of the president's close friends was being used by the communists. Yes? McCarthy was 100% correct.
Historian Bill Federer with us here today on Crosstalk, September 11th, a look through history, and trust that it's been very insightful to learn more of this information. We're going to the phone calls here, though, in our final segment. Not a lot of time that we have right now, but let's go right to the calls. We're going to begin in Ocean City, Maryland. Hi, James, you're on the air.
Yes, sir, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, I just had a couple of comments about some of the things that the gentleman is saying. I guess most recently, like about Benghazi. I know a lot of people put a lot of blame on different people, but I served two tours in Afghanistan, once as a designated marksman with the Marine Corps and the second as a squad leader. And there's many times over there where you don't get the support that you ask for. You can ask for it as much as you want, and if you don't get it, you don't get it. And many Americans have died because of that reason. And I've never understood the connection between, just because it had something to do with Hillary Clinton, it's this huge thing that we have to remember. Well, what about the other 4,000 Americans that have died that nobody cares about until, you can put the blame on a politician, especially a Democrat.
Okay. Bill, your thoughts on that?
Thank you for your service, and thank all those that have served in the military. And lots of friends of mine have served over there. I was recently with General Jerry Boykin, and he gives his testimony of how he was wounded, and he was the commander of the Somalia situation, Black Hawk Down, and he even in a speech said their God is not the same as our God, and under the Bush administration they pushed him out of the military because he was willing to say that the Islamic God is not the same as the God of the Bible. Anyway, strength brings peace, weakness brings attack. And when we went over there and we demonstrated strength, it became peaceful. But when President Obama pulled us out, it showed weakness. Now, there's a couple examples earlier. Jimmy Carter, the Shah of Iran, was our friend. He was pro-West. And I went to college with some Iranian students. They had American flags on their dorm room walls. I actually met the Shah's son, the Shah of Iran. The Shah was pro-American, but Jimmy Carter pulled the rug out from the Shah and let the fundamentalist Ayatollah take over. And this was a signal to the Muslim world that America was abandoning its allies. Reagan, I love Ronald Reagan, but when the Muslims blew up our U.S. Marine barracks in Lebanon and killed 241 U.S. Marines, Reagan's response was to pull all the American troops out of Lebanon. Again, another example of America retreating. And then when President Obama fired Mubarak, who was our ally in Egypt, these were signals that America is showing weakness in that area of the world and that we're withdrawing. And as a result, it caused the fundamentalist ones to become more violent because the weakness invites aggression. We had 8 years of that under Obama. It was a genocide of the Christian population in the Middle East. These Christian areas in Syria and in Iraq, where they just little Christian communities, they existed for 2,000 years, suffered persecutions. Finally, under Obama, they were wiped out. And so this has happened. Now, Trump, thankfully, has been reversing this and has been stopping these efforts to arm the Palestinians and give them millions of dollars and arm these terrorists. And again, so we need to stand behind our military, and we need to realize that strength is what's going to bring peace, withdrawing and showing weakness.
Well, we had the strongest military force present over there in 2010. We had more Americans die in Afghanistan in the summer of 2010 than we have in the entire rest of the war. We had more Marines over there than we ever have in Afghanistan that particular time, and more people died than any other summer. We called it the blood summer, especially in Marja, Sangin, Sistani, Lashkargah, all those areas where we were. It was the most hostile place in the world, and we had the most presence there.
James, thank you so much. And Bill, and we're down to just 3 minutes here. Is it the amount of presence that is there, or what dictates are given to the leadership as to how they can carry out their military policy?
Right. Well, it also has to do with the funneling of weapons. So America, believe it or not, was arming the militants, arming the rebels. There's a Los Angeles Times headline. It says, forces armed by the CIA were fighting forces armed by the Pentagon.
And then there's another article in Time magazine where it says Trump ended Obama's program of arming the Muslim rebels, the terrorists. Another article of U.S. weapons being given to our quote-unquote allies being quote-unquote lost and then finding their way into the fundamentalist Muslim hands. And so one of the reasons that we were facing this conflict that was heating up is because there were subversive groups within our own government that was arming the bad guys. You know, even pictures of McCain with the head of ISIS, these different leaders in ISIS, and he was over there. And so it's either total naivety or somebody's working an agenda. But nevertheless, strength, always projected strength, perceived strength is the way to peace.
And I guess the other point, Bill, that you drew out earlier is that there are members of the military who courageously were going to wishing to go to be dispatched to Benghazi to offer aid, but they were told to stand down.
Right. And, you know, but not understanding their mindset. I spent 3 hours with a 30-year military intelligence officer, and I went through this concept of the 1,400-year history of Islamic expansion. And he was saying, this is really interesting. We're only taught that you're not supposed to offend them. And we read the Kite Runner book where a little boy that was raped, and you have to understand that's their culture. They rape little boys, and you have to be sensitive to that, and they beat their women. I said, no, you have to understand, when you are really careful not to insult them, that's an encouragement to them to become more violent. And you have to understand there's the way you act as an individual, and there's the way you act as a government. The government has to project strength.
James, thank you for your service. Thank you for your call today. We're down to less than 30 seconds. I wish we could go further, but time's not going to allow us for that. But thank you so much for the call today.
Thank you. Thank you, James.
It was James from Ocean City, and I apologize to other people online right now. We don't have time for additional calls. Bill Fitterer is our guest, and he's got a number of resources, DVDs on this issue. His book also is there, What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran. You can go to his website at AmericanMinute.com. That's AmericanMinute.com. September 11th, a look through history. Bill Fitterer, as always, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Jim.
And folks, thanks for listening today. I trust it's opened your eyes of understanding in many regards. Thanks so much for listening today to Crosstalk as we remember.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208, or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.